@resonancefm.com. Welcome to Interesting Conversations. I'm Wendy Jones, and I'm delighted to welcome into the studio today the acclaimed novelist and now memoirist, Nick Barley. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Wendy. Good to be here.
Thank you very much. It's pouring outside, so it's nice to be inside, isn't it? New memoir, Scattered Ghosts, out in a couple of weeks. It's quite an extraordinary book about your family, your recent family and your distant family's history, and they're coming from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Revolution, through Second World War particularly, through the Revolution, to Yorkshire, London, a huge swathe.
Yeah, I mean, when I started to write a family history, I had no idea I was going to be able to go back as far as I did. And it's an interesting thing because I think in the end it's become a kind of 200-year history of Hungarian Jews.
Yes, it has really, hasn't it? Yes.
And there aren't any books really about that. There are lots of books, obviously, on Austro-Hungary and Austro-Hungarian Empire and First World War, Second World War, and plight of Jews during the Second World War. 56, there's a book for every bullet hole. It's quite incredible. But I really wanted to sort of tie all of these stories together, all the way to sort of modern Britain.
Yes.
My experience of growing up in the 70s, modern, you know, National Front and that whole decade. And then really the first wave of Eastern European migrants, the sort of post-communism migration to Britain. So it became this book of spanning 200 years, but that wasn't my intention really when I started it. I didn't know what my intention was.
You've also done it in an unusual way. You've written four novels. You're almost one of the Granter Young Writers of the Decade. Apart from you were 2 months old, were you?
Yes, yeah. I was on the list and kicked off for being too old to be young.
But only by about a month, because it wasn't very much, was it?
Yeah, there were a few months in it, a few critical, bureaucratic months.
Well, but you've written novels, and now you've written a memoir. It's usually the way around, isn't it? The memoir usually comes first, and it's usually very intimate and a lot of quite family and anecdotal family in content. But you've written a really stonkingly intelligent, well-researched memoir of your larger family.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I could say I've been writing it all my life in some ways, because you kind of become an unwitting repository, collector, curator of fragments and stories and so on. But then, of course, a lot of stuff is unspoken, and my grandmother never talked about her war experiences. My father had some very dark, difficult experiences during the war as well. And I think a lot of Hungarians in particular don't talk about the war. They'll talk about 56. 56
was the revolution.
Yeah. And the point at which a lot of Hungarian lives turned because they fled Soviet tanks. So a lot of them are willing to talk about 56. In fact, some of them don't stop talking about 56. But it's almost as if there is this emotional line drawn around sort of mid late 40s, and they don't talk about their war experiences, and then few of them know or have researched all of the family stuff going back into Austro-Hungary and even beyond that.
One thing you talk about quite often as a theme, we have a lot of facts about what happened to Hungarian Jewish people and where they went to Auschwitz. And you talk about the great big numbers and the statistics. What you also mentioned is this is these great historical facts are also ordinary or important moments in ordinary family history.
Mm. Yep. I mean, I was very conscious that, history is often about extraordinary people doing extraordinary things, mm-hmm. and more specifically, big men doing big things. Yeah. And I was very conscious of the unwritten histories of ordinary people. And it just so happens that, you know, there are family members who were present in whatever around the 1848, 1850s period of Hungarian history, then the First World War, the Second World War, 1956, and so on. So I was conscious of the people who haven't, been written about or go unrepresented.
Or swallowed up by the great big statistics.
Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned Auschwitz, great grandmother. I mean, obviously, I never knew her, never really knew of her. But we had, by accident, a letter that she wrote 3 weeks before deportation. And nobody had read it for 65 years. It was virtually indecipherable. Only my mum could sort of decipher bits of it. And then researching it, it was possible to piece together her life and her final 3 weeks in particular.
You also talk about your father as a young boy hiding in the cellar.
Mm.
That was very moving, while people are shot for being Jewish around him in the courtyard.
Yeah. That was a story I'd been aware of all my life, that my father and my cousin's father, who were best friends and their mothers were best friends, were hidden by a friendly concierge in the building they lived in during the Hungarian fascist pogroms, really, just prior to... this was post the German invasion and just after the Hungarian fascists took power in Hungary. So they carried out these fairly random killings. And so I knew this story all my life, but I didn't know anything else about it. And as it turned out, nobody had ever written about it. And I managed to track down various witnesses or people who knew something about it.
But there was no actually really written history about it. That's what you
Nothing.
Came across, even though many people had been killed in
yeah.
one evening.
Yeah. The general circumstances of that period, 1944, October 44, are fairly well known. Hungary was trying to get out of the war. That's why the Nazis invaded. I mean, obviously they were Nazi allies, but when they tried to get out, the Nazis invaded. And there was a very strong Hungarian fascist element in Hungary, which came into power in October 44. And that's where these pogroms, shootings by the Danube, and all of this is fairly well documented. But this particular event,
no,
there was nothing about. And I really wanted to find as much as possible to show that it had taken place in the way that I'd heard from my childhood. And I remember talking to my cousin's father, who's died quite a while ago now. And obviously my cousin knew something of it. So these fragments were what I started with. But then finding the graves on which there was clearly a falsified date and in an odd part of the Jewish cemetery, all of these things kind of flowed together to show that on a certain night in a certain building, roughly 20, 22 men were executed by the Hungarian fascists.
One thing I noticed about Scatter's Ghost is the structure is very inventive. There are a list of photographs, there's a little dialogue, imagined dialogue, you come in authorially, you question. And I did think of W.G. Sebald, he's bringing together fragments from Central Europe at a certain time and trying to weave them into something cohesive, almost putting together back a family that has been spread and dispersed across many countries.
Well, actually, I mean, that's a very good way of putting it, because there is this genuine Hungarian diaspora over many years. It's not just because of the War of the Revolution, even before then. And I know what you mean about Sebald. I mean, obviously, I was writing something non-fictional, so I didn't put anything in that didn't happen or that wasn't part of some family tale that couldn't in some way be substantiated. But I didn't want to be bound by any conventions. I didn't want to write a history book. I'm not a historian. I have been a journalist, but I did not want to write a piece of reportage. I really wanted the material to suggest a form, or for the material to suggest a form when it came to particular characters. There are three male characters and three female characters, and then the family flowing together really at 1956 and then splitting, with some of the family staying in Hungary and the other half fleeing.
Writing is a theme, as well as a book that you've written, it is a theme within it. Your father was a writer, Stephen Barlay, and he grew up, and your mum grew up as well, by the Nobel Prize-winning writer, Imre Curtis. And you're a writer, and there is this very literary feel, an exploration of what it is to be a writer, to be a voice, when so many voices have been lost.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. Obviously, Imre Curtis, who's a Nobel Prize-winning writer, was a neighbour of my mum and sister. So they grew up in the same building. He was arrested on his way to work at the age of 15 on sort of forced labour and ended up in concentration camps. And most of his literature has been about that, really. Then, obviously, the book is kind of framed by two photographs, me taken by my mum at my dad's typewriter at the age of six or even younger. And obviously, I grew up with this image of my dad's typewriter. But you're right, there is another element to it which I think was important. The writer in some ways becomes a kind of totalitarian, deciding who should be in this family history and who shouldn't, or which stories are represented and which aren't. And at one point, my brother, I knew he'd say this, but he accused me of sort of airbrushing him out. But it's a very good point, because one does that. And one takes responsibility for what one includes or excludes.
And that's one of your epigrams, your brother saying, you airbrush. I was in that scene, you airbrushed me out. Yeah. But your other epigram, I thought was, especially after I read it, seems so apposite and powerful. It is, knock upon yourself as if upon a door and walk upon yourself as if upon a straight road. It's a very high demand to be explorative and direct with yourself. Is that by it? Sylvanus?
Yes. I just felt that it's very easy to say, well, I'm going to write it my way and just get on with it and type. But I think that with family histories, there is always this sense of you are representing the living and the dead.
Yeah.
And it's not, you don't have to take their views into account necessarily, but I was conscious that in representing them, I was also representing myself and also representing the broader history. And how, in a sense, the second generation takes on a previous generation's experiences and the whole transmission of it. So it is this constant process of self-questioning or knocking on yourself.
And maybe even how we need to know, is a need to know the stories and the experiences of the generation that came immediately before us and further back.
Yeah, I felt that strongly, that sure, there is this thing about, you know, where have I come from? But the interesting thing is with a lot of the Hungarian Jews of that generation, they really many that I've met are quite happy not to know certain things and not to revisit things. So I did feel that this whole knocking on myself was also knocking on doors that often refused to be opened or didn't wish to be opened.
Or weren't ready to be opened, even though maybe half a century before, still aren't ready to be opened.
And still aren't ready, absolutely. And certainly in contemporary Hungary, there are still these issues, and they're not just latent, they're quite overt. The whole sort of strand of Hungarian anti-Semitism has endured despite the fact that there are very few relatively Jews left in Hungary. But obviously at the moment Hungary is going through a major thing with the EU and wrangles with the EU and constitutional issues, and it's kind of seen by some as a sort of black sheep of Europe for the way it's messing with its constitution. And obviously some people see that in a quite fearful way, because that has happened in the past in Hungary. So I think there are a lot of people who just don't want to revisit the old wounds and so on. And I know it's painful for members of my family to do that. And certainly when my paternal grandmother was still alive, she never wanted to talk about that stuff at all.
You are describing, what struck me, Nick, in your memoir, is that you're describing a world which, to me, really did feel and seem, and certainly from my knowledge, has disappeared. And it wasn't sort of now in continuum from how it was 50, 100 years ago. It feels like a world that's gone. And I was very struck by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole ghost thing is something that informed the whole book. I could describe it as a cadence of appearance and disappearance. People appearing from on the basis of a fragment of paper or some reference or some half-remembered name. And the writer then wills them into existence because you do the necessary research or ask the questions and so on. And then you're right. I mean, this is a disappearing world. In particular, for instance, the generation of Hungarians who fled to Britain in 1956. I mean, many of them ended up in Britain arbitrarily, and it happened to coincide with a lot of immigration from Britain's colonies as well. I mean, 56 was part of, you know, Windrush was in 1948, and so my parents, when they were first in London, lived among Jamaican medical students as well, who were among the first of their generation to come to Britain. But you're right, this is a disappearing world, and in particular with the Hungarians, that generation is getting on and dying, and who is left to tell their story was also a driving force in the whole thing.
There's extremely moving. I mean, it's well, another thing is it's a very quiet book, really, and unsensationalist, but it's extremely moving within that quietude. And you tell a story about your mother and father escaping from Hungary and just pretending to be on a day trip, so they have nothing but a book of Greek myths and a hotel ticket and a handbag, but they're going and they aren't coming back and they don't know where they're going. And your mother has a book of Greek myths with her, which turns out to be quite pivotal, I suppose, in her whole life, especially in a writer's life, married to a writer with a writer for a son to come.
And it definitely impressed some of the Hungarian border guards on the way out. But they had a kind of elaborate plan for leaving. I mean, obviously, a lot of Hungarians fled during that period. And my father and mother left fairly late in December rather than in October, November, where a lot of people left. So the borders were much tighter. And it was really a question of, in fact, my father, I think, booked a hotel room to give the illusion that they were going to stay and
be returning.
That's right. Yeah. And no luggage to give the illusion they're just going on a day trip and coming back. So that and the forged papers hastily put together with sort of potatoes and
potato stamps. Letters kind of, and smudged so it looked authentically Hungarian.
Exactly, yeah. That was something they were very conscious of. No Hungarian stamp at the time looked like a stamp, it was just a smudge. So the authentic smudge was a key part of the deception. Yeah.
I suppose it must have been easier to emigrate before computers. I mean, you could make it look a bit more homemade, couldn't you?
You could knock something up these days that was more convincing. Yeah.
And they came rather arbitrarily. They were in Vienna and the bus came from England with clothes for the Hungarian refugees. And the consul said, well, he didn't want the buses to go back empty. So people lined up and there was a great... Tell the story about your father not being able to find his papers.
Yeah, I mean... Obviously, A, he was worried about the questions that would be asked at borders, but there was, you know, a lot of British sympathy towards Hungary. And obviously, this has been debated forever, should there have been or not intervention and that type of thing. But at one point, I think students from a couple of universities sent clothes to the refugees in Vienna. And this British consul was kind of minded not to allow them to return empty. So just load them up with whoever was there. And that period of uncertainty was characterized by Hungarians going to any and every embassy. So, you know, my parents could have ended up in Argentina, Australia, wherever there was an opening. And it was just arbitrary, accidental, that it was to Britain. I mean, a lot of Hungarians who ended up in Britain then moved as far as they could away from Europe, to Canada in particular. But I think my parents always had a kind of rose-tinted view of Britain. And obviously, Britain had a huge reputation because of the Second World War, which was only, you know, barely a decade or more before. So I think they were very happy that they ended up in Britain. But it really could have been anywhere.
But your father was in the queue to get on the bus and they asked to see the official papers and he couldn't find them. He had many pockets and he couldn't find them. And so he said, he stepped out of the queue and he said, oh, I'll look for my papers. And the guy said, oh, if you say you have them, then you have them. And there was all people applauded and there was just this new sense that you could believe people on their word. There was no suspicion or distrust underneath people's words.
Yeah, I mean, he remembers that as a very sort of moving moment because somebody actually believed what he said. I mean, a friend of his was allowed entry on the basis that he loved Shakespeare.
And he couldn't even speak English because he said it in a broken...
Shakespeare, yeah. That was good
it
enough
worked.
For the British, yeah. Obviously, there were then in the aftermath of that, I mean, all kinds of ironies because the British, obviously, 50s and 60s, the Cold War was heating up or not. And one of the things I was interested in was the way in which the former Hungarian citizens were surveyed by the former, you know, by the state and the shenanigans of these kind of Cold War spies in Britain. And you, from the state security archives, it was possible to discover all kinds of Hungarians who were sent to or dispatched to Britain under the guise of being Hungarian refugees in order to find out about dissidents. And my father, having worked for the radio, was definitely on the radar. So he'd had to escape at that point in late 56. And so it's not surprising that he was kind of shadowed. But it's also interesting that many of the Hungarians who were asked to do this just did not want to give information that would have been useful. So it was this balance of compromising yet not being compromised. They weren't ideologues. They were just forced to do this. And I think a lot of people in the subsequent years were forced to, not as badly as in East Germany and some other Eastern European countries where there was real pressure on people to provide information or denounce and so on. That went on in Hungary, but these characters who turned up in London in the 50s and 60s, really did not want to provide anything useful to the authorities.
One of my question is stylistic. You have written a lot of very sensational, very moving, very shocking stories and facts into your memoir, but your style is not sensationalist. It's not vulgar. It's not overexposed. Can you say a little bit about that, please, Nick?
I was conscious of, as I mentioned, various of the sort of conventions that you have in nonfiction, the sort of journey of the writer through, as an example. And I'm not saying that's one. It's often
it's
an engaging
a used
one,
isn't it?
But it is a used one.
Yeah.
And it forces the author center stage, and everything they do suddenly becomes magnified. Mm-hmm. Every train they take, every place they go, and so on.
Yes, it's quite interesting that often very, very insignificant things they imbue with a lot of importance, things you would quite readily discard, I think, as experiences.
I agree, and I'm not saying they're bad. You know, all the books written in that mode are bad books.
But it is a stylistic convention.
Yeah, and I wanted to write about people from the inside, as it were. So one, there is parts of the book that are in the first, almost third person present tense, and I appear and disappear at moments because in the end, I have pieced the whole thing together, and I'm not hiding from that responsibility in any way. But I wanted to try to get as close to the people, the characters, as possible, and partly to give readers an insight into those lives as well, almost from their point of view, without fictionalizing or coming up with fancy bits of dialogue that didn't take place.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So it was really to allow the material to suggest its own form or forms.
And have its own power, really, without being over-decorated.
Yeah, yeah. But on the other hand, not disguise the fact that I found it a very moving, emotional thing.
It must have been, actually.
Do.
It must have been quite grueling, I'd imagine, to do.
And, I mean, this was an American friend of mine who had this phrase, second-generation trauma. It probably is only Americans who could come up with that kind of phrase. But it is an odd thing that stuff that one generation doesn't talk about, you then find out about, and you find yourself being, very moved by the experiences of people you might have known but are dead, people you didn't know even.
And maybe more than me, maybe also affected or overshadowed.
Yeah.
Possibly.
No, absolutely. It was very difficult to look at some of the stuff that I found or talk to some of the people that I, tracked down without partly feeling that you're intruding on something. But then once you have intruded, you kind of take on all the emotions as well.
But also the joy. You talk often about cherry cake. You'd be there with cherry pie. Sorry, cherry pie. You'd be there. You would. This theme of cherry pie, of joy and bounty, also runs through the memoir quite consistently as well. It's not a dour book by any means.
No,
it's an intellectual book, but it's not dour.
Well, I'm glad that you think that, because I mean, obviously, cherry pie, cherry strudel, is an important part of the family, and it kind of has linked it over 200 years, and long may it.
It sounds great. I've never had it.
Well, if you go to Budapest, I mean, every street corner practically, you will find purveyors of cherry strudel, and they're all different. They're never identical.
Cherry's just seasonal, though, because it takes a lot of cherries to make a cherry tart.
Okay, well, the two key cherries are the sweet and sour one, and Čerešnja and Medj. They're two different types of cherries, so there are all kinds of things that are done with them.
Okay, but you've done your research, Nick, haven't you?
Yeah.
Well, Scattered Ghosts by Nick Barley is out a couple of weeks' time, in the middle of October, towards the end of October, by Taurus, and I really recommend it. It's very intelligent and subtle and beautifully researched and very, very moving, and I loved reading it. Thank you very much, Nick Barley, for coming in today.
Thank you.
This has been Interesting Conversations.
Like the Bitcoin. Resonance 104.4 FM.